Thank you, Walt. I understand now what it means to be a pilgrim people. I've been traveling with him since yesterday, and making sure we got here was a major effort, and appreciate that. I want to wish you all a happy St. Francis Day, the 4th of October, 800th anniversary of St. Francis. I suppose that's why all the flowers are up here. I hope that's the reason they're up here. Looks kind of foreboding otherwise, doesn't it? Well, you notice I'm standing vertically at least. Please, we're running out of time. I'm planning to do the following. I'm going to use most of the time allotted me to say something about a Lutheran family portrait. And then, if there are a few comments, because I'm going to try to sketch just a little bit about how I see the four major Lutheran church bodies. I should say four of the major Lutheran church bodies, since I'm not going to talk about the Wisconsin Synod, and it is, in fact, larger than the AELC. I'm going to speak about the four Lutheran bodies that are in the Lutheran Council USA, and I may make some mistakes, or I may say some things that aren't quite accurate. So I'm going to try to allow a little rebuttal time before the end of the period here this afternoon. And then this evening, I hope we will be able to continue the discussion, perhaps some reflections of yours or observations or ideas about either the present or the future or even the past. But this one is called Lutheran Family Portrait. And if you ever want to have fun sometime, take a movie of people taking a family picture. It is my wife's family is a family of 11 children. And we gathered for a family portrait once. And I happened to have a movie camera along, so I stood over at the side as they were lining up the 11 children for the picture, and I ran out of film finally. As people squared them around and rearranged them and ran off to the camera and came back, tried to get it all organized, it was really a delightful study in efforts to look your best for posterity, and ending up with a lot of frayed tempers, as you can well imagine, and seven managers out of 11 siblings. proved really difficult. Now, I fortunately don't have 11 siblings to deal with, although there are at present 18 Lutheran bodies in this country, 17 actually. The 18th is a collection of 11 independent congregations, which you may be aware of out here. Many others are also collections of independent congregations, but they've been able to find a common name at least for themselves. They range from the International Lutheran Fellowship, which has five congregations, to the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod, which has nearly 1,300 congregations. A number of those smaller bodies, which I will not be discussing in detail, are ethnic in origin. There is the older Apostolic Lutheran Church out of the Finnish tradition, and then two newer groups, the Latvians and the Estonians, have now organized bodies in this country. So they've maintained that tradition. And then, of course, there are a whole variety of groups that see themselves in one sense or another as preserving a true Lutheran heritage over against some of the larger bodies. There, you know, the Church of the Lutheran Confession, the CLC as it's sometimes called. There is also, however, the Concordia Lutheran Conference, which has the same initials and I think probably the same self-image. Now, we are going to concentrate, however, on the largest of these, except, as I say, for the exception of the AELC, but the ones that are involved in this conference, and try to say a little bit about each of them. I want to start with the oldest member of the family, which is the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. I say oldest because I'm thinking of it as a continually existing church body. As you know, it goes back to the migration of Germans to this country in the late 1830s, and although it's been engaged many times, it's never gotten married with anybody else. It has engaged, I'm thinking there basically of the somewhat broad relationship within the old synodical conference. It has, however, assimilated some other Lutheran groups, Norwegian groups. That is why its last president had a Norwegian name and a Norwegian background. Slovak groups as well. Thus, it has continued its own existence, although it has incorporated other groups within it. this eldest member of the family continues to cooperate with other Lutheran bodies through the Lutheran Council, although on a selective basis. There are some aspects of the Lutheran Council which the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod does not support, and others which it does. One of the prime priorities for the Church has been the theological discussions that have been carried on within the Lutheran Council. And as we look to the future, people are asking now what might be the relationship of the Missouri Synod to other Lutheran bodies as we move toward a new Lutheran church and eventually toward such a body. And I can't predict, but I would guess that there would be a very strong interest, at least in maintaining cooperative theological conversations between the Missouri Synod and whatever the other group may be called, and also combining Missouri Synod delegates with other Lutheran groups as they converse with other Christian bodies. When Lutherans and Roman Catholics began dialoguing 17 years ago, the Missouri Synod was not a part of that discussion because it was carried on through the instrumentality of the Lutheran World Federation, of which the Missouri Synod was not a member. But very shortly after the origin of those talks with the Roman Catholics, Missouri was invited to participate and did indeed send members, and in fact, one of those members was Arthur Carl Peepcorn, who astounded the Roman Catholics with his knowledge of Catholic history and was a very excellent representative and architect of several of the early study documents in the Lutheran Roman Catholic series. Missouri Synod Lutherans continue to work with other Lutherans on the dialogue teams, and I presume that that will continue at least for the near future. Most of the dialogues, in fact, that are being sponsored by Lutherans are through the Lutheran Council, and Missouri Synod is actively engaged in that. The size, of course, of the Missouri Synod, you may know, 2.8 million, makes it the second largest of the Lutheran bodies in baptized membership. We all know that it has a strong parochial school system. It also has the most Sunday schools. It doesn't have the most pupils, but the most Sunday schools. Interesting statistic. Apparently, more congregations have Sunday schools, but the average size is not as large. Lutheran Church Missouri Synod also has the largest benevolence budget, proportionately. That is, it gives more of its income to benevolence than any of the other four Lutheran bodies. My impression, if I were to say what I see as Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's posture today, is that the Synod is ready to start writing a new chapter in its history. With the election of Ralph Bowman as president, it has an individual who I think is committed to the conservative doctrinal stance of the Synod, but is also eager to maintain appropriate levels of communication and cooperation with other Lutheran bodies. He has indicated again and again that it is not comfortable for him and for his Synod to be apart from other Lutherans, but they feel at the present time that is the consistent position with their concerns and their own tradition. I believe, however, that he will, and I think the Synod with him is eager to find ways in which they can work with other Lutherans within the framework of those commitments. I would see the next years with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod as being years perhaps of locating some new areas of work. I think that we may have reached a kind of low point at the present in areas of cooperation, and hopefully we will be able to move toward some broader cooperative efforts, perhaps in some new areas. There was an article by Bruce Gunnarsson some years ago called How to Tell a Lutheran. I've referred to it several times in various contexts because it's a lot of fun, has a lot of little neat things in it, and if I were to say something about what Missouri Synod Lutherans believe, I'd quote Gunnarsson in one of those capacities and say that Missouri Synod Lutherans believe that it's wrong to vote for a political candidate on purely religious grounds unless he is a Lutheran. The AELC is the adolescent in the family. The word adolescent, you may know, means maturing or growing. The AELC is an interesting body because it came into being with a purpose of not staying in existence. It came into being with the goal of becoming a catalyst for some wider Lutheran unity in the United States and perhaps in Canada. As it's turning out, that's exactly what did occur. It was the entry of the AELC into the American Lutheran Church in America negotiations that became the catalyst with its call for Lutheran Union 3 years ago. That became the catalyst to move us off the dime on which we had been poised gracefully for some 7 years. And if you think it's easy to stand on a dime with another church body for 7 years, you don't know. It's a real feat. Sorry. But the genesis of the interest in such wider Lutheran unity came partly from the internal dynamics of the AELC. Having moved out of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, where I'd been actively involved in a tremendous number of the overseas and other activities of the church, it found itself with a financial base somewhat slimmer and not capable of carrying on the wide ministries that it had done before. And so it saw that its future would lie in combining with and working with other Lutherans. It immediately joined the Lutheran Council, became an active member of that organization, and is looking toward the possibility of other ways to cooperate. As many of you know, Seminex now is in the process of integration with at least three other Lutheran seminaries, and it will, as I understand it, continue to provide support for the faculty members who will go on those faculties through the next years, and thus, in a way, contribute to Lutheran theological education on a fairly wide basis, as it has in the last years, because many of its graduates have already entered the ministries of the other Lutheran bodies. It's no wonder, it seems to me, that a body with this kind of background and goal voted unanimously, 136-0, for merger at the convention this last month. And leadership of the AELC is already strongly at work in the Commission of 70, or the Commission for a New Lutheran Church. In size, of course, the AELC is much, much smaller than the other two bodies that are discussing merger. Its membership is about 108,000. Again, Bruce Gunnarsson, AELC Lutherans believe in miracles. And miracles, and sometimes even expect them, particularly during stewardship drives. Subsequent one on that, too. They also enjoy church suppers and will frequently pay as much as a dollar for the privilege of bringing the family. The American Lutheran Church is the child of a broken home, in fact, of many broken homes. For those of us not in the American Lutheran Church, it comes as something of a surprise to look back in its history and to discover that although it's the product of many mergers, almost every one of the mergers was difficult and left behind some splinter groups. I was once teaching church history to seminary students and was trying to find some simple way of describing all of the complexities of merger that occurred early in the 20th century. And when I got to the Norwegians, which were a very complex bunch of synodical groups and organizations, one sort and another, I thought, well, I'll just do a little statistical summary. I'll do a sort of input-output analysis. I'll take the number of Norwegian synods in 1890, which was seven, and then there were a number of mergers, three major mergers, and then give the number in 1920. So I said seven in, three mergers, and then I discovered that there were 11 bodies. after the mergers were over, and that, well, it's funny if you're not in, if you're not involved in it, it's really a very painful thing. And in fact, in 1960, you remember that when four Lutheran bodies came together to form the American Lutheran Church, one of those groups, the Lutheran Free Church, was not able to bring all of its congregations along, and the Association of Free Lutheran Congregations was founded. And in fact, then there were some legal actions over what name that group could take, because it wanted to continue the tradition of the Lutheran Free Church. So that those of us who are not in the ALC need to keep in mind that merger has not always been a happy process for sister church bodies, and that when one goes into it, then one must recognize that fact. I was recently at the convention of the ALC in San Diego, and some of you were there and remember that the balloting over the 31 members for this commission for New Lutheran Church became rather complex, and there was a good deal of discussion, at least in the halls and over coffee, about which candidates were from which subgroups within the ALC. Coming out of the LCA, I'm not so acquainted with that kind of identification with candidates for particular subgroupings within the larger church. I think in some ways those of us who are not in the ALC are not aware of the continuing traditions of some of those backgrounds that go on. Becoming a president of a college in the ALC, also I've become aware of some of those traditions. A friend of mine who was delighted that I was going to go to an ALC college just shook his head and said, however, that I was going to absolutely the wrong one, and told me why. It had to do with a controversy his father was engaged in back in the early 1900s, and he still felt very deeply about that that division. But I think that if we understand that, it's clearer why the leadership of the ALC had been much more cautious about moving toward organic union. There had been, in the last 10 years, this committee, first Committee on Church Cooperation, then Committee on Lutheran Unity, after the AELC joined, and the constant point of view of the folks from the American Lutheran Church had been, merger is going to take so much time and so much energy, we are going to lose mission, we're going to lose momentum for what the church is really intended to do. And while those of us on the outside often saw that as foot dragging, it's clearer and clearer that there was a very deep concern there, as would be the case with any administrators, for trying to keep the body together and moving forward without losing time and energy in internecine squabbles. Therefore, it was a tremendous surprise to everyone, and not least those of you in the ALC, I think, when the vote for merger was 91% in favor. It was a great surprise. I had attended the day before a luncheon at the convention of the Lutheran Church in America in Louisville, and the discussion was how will the ALC vote? And there were many rumors, rumors that a poll taken as people had come in had said that only 50% or 51% were favorable toward merger. Later discussion, I was in the Iowa delegation, and there were a number of pastors from Iowa who were very negative from the ALC about moving into merger at this time. And the Iowa delegation was very pessimistic as to whether merger would even pass at the ALC convention. Those who were there, however, in San Diego said that after the hearings, it became clear that the nucleus for opposition was relatively small, and it seemed the same people were appearing again and again, the same arguments being used, and apparently delegates felt that, and by the time of the vote, there was a very strong tide moving in favor of merger. But no one, including, I've heard of no one, maybe you can correct me, but heard of no one who predicted that the vote would be over 90%. Most optimistic was perhaps somewhere in the 80s, but it was indeed a surprise. And now the mood seems to be in the ALC leadership that since the move toward merger is inevitable, let's get on with it, do it as quickly as possible so that we can get back to doing the other things that the church needs to do. In size, the ALC is 2.4 million baptized members. In general, ALC congregations tend to be somewhat larger on the average than some of the congregations of the other Lutheran church bodies. I think folks in the ALC may not realize that. They often talk themselves as having numbers of small congregations, but that's typical of Lutherans in this country generally. In fact, the body with the smallest average size congregation is the AELC by some wide margin. Before going to the LCA, Bruce Gunnarsson again about Lutherans. ALC Lutherans. He says, wonder a lot about people named Olson and Schneider who belong to other churches beside Lutheran churches. They also wonder about people named O'Brien and Gagliano who belong to Lutheran churches. ALC Lutherans believe in offering an honorarium to a guest speaker. If he declines it, they believe in inviting him back. The LCA is a member of the family that has been declaring itself eligible for marriage for years and years. It is the only Lutheran body that has, from its beginning, had a standing committee on approaches to Lutheran unity. That committee has never sat. And out of pure mercy to those people who have been standing around since 1963, Bishop Crumley appointed a new standing committee on approaches to unity and appointed the 31 members of the LCA who are working in the Commission for a New Lutheran Church. So at last, they'll be able to sit down and get to work. And the dream of the LCA, which had in its constitution that it believed in and was working for as one of its purposes, a larger union of Lutherans in North America, has now begun to bear fruit. It was by a very large vote, and this was a surprisingly large vote to me, some 98% vote favorable to union at Louisville. I say that it's surprising to me because it was, as you know, a written ballot. And for years I had been hearing from people in the Lutheran Church in America, particularly from my friends in South Carolina, where there, when we went through the merger in 1963, there was not a single new church added to the old South Carolina Synod, and they now look for another merger down the road and probably will not get another congregation either, since there's no ALC had been no ALC congregation in the state. There's now a mission in the state, but it's in an area where there are already three other LCA churches, so I don't know whether it'll ever get to be organized or whether it will wither before that time. But there had been persons in that delegation and others who were very, very nervous about merger, and I thought that the opportunity to vote at a secret ballot might bring out some of those concerns, and it did not. It brought out 11 of them, but I thought that there might be upwards of 50 or 60 persons who would express concern. But the LCA tradition in merger has been generally smooth. The earliest of the merging traditions was in 1917-18. It was an interesting situation because in some respects we are paralleling it today, I think. There had been three bodies that had been discussing the possibility of merger for nearly 10 years. They'd had free theological conferences, they'd had debates, they'd had discussions. There was a committee working, and it would bring modest recommendations, and nothing was ever accomplished. In 1917, the anniversary of the 95 Theses occasioned a joint committee to look at how that might be celebrated. It was largely a lay committee, and when the lay people got together, they said, well, the best way to celebrate the 95 Theses and the Reformation would be to merge these three Lutheran bodies that have been talking for so long. And within a year, merger had been accomplished, and in 1918, the United Lutheran Church in America came into existence. And that went very well. It went well because it was a rather loose federation, and it was possible for the synods which formed that church body in 1918 to bring in many of their idiosyncrasies and their own institutions and their projects and continue them within the larger United Lutheran Church. Through the years of existence of the United Lutheran Church, however, gradually the national profile grew more prominent, and under the leadership of Franklin Clark Fry, that national character of the church became more and more pronounced. It was certainly increased significantly when in 1963 the LCA merged with the Augustana tradition and with the Finns and the Happy Danes to form the Lutheran Church in America. I say Happy Danes, I'm sure you know the Happy Danes and the Gloomy Danes. Happy Danes had a college and have a college in Grandview, in Des Moines, called Grandview College. Someone gave me an illustration recently of why they were called the Happy Danes. The president of that college was showing a guest around, and he, this was some years back, and brought the guest into their new dormitory, the women's dormitory, and it was at night, and the lounge area was quite dark. So we turned on the lights to show them the furnishings, and all the furniture was occupied, so to speak, with couples, and so he showed them the room, and then he carefully turned out the light when he left again. And that was quoted as a way in which that Danish tradition was more warm and accepting than rigid and judgmental. But within the Lutheran Church in America, there have been some continuing traditions. They have been cared for, though, usually through special conferences. There was a German conference and a Finnish special interest conference, so that persons with particular ethnic traditions, for example, could maintain some identity and common work. But by and large, the merger seems to have erased many of the former traditions. There are Augustana people all over the church who still speak with nostalgia of the old Augustana and remember the good old days. The Augustana tradition helped centralize or nationalize, perhaps would be a better word, the Lutheran Church in America. And those who went through the merger in 1963 experienced a moving of some authority from the synods to the national church, so that we were presented with what was called a bipolar tradition, where there was a congregation on the one side and the national church on the other. But looked at from the outside, the LCA still has a very strong regional component that some of the other church bodies do not have. I want to say a word about that, because I think it's significant for all Lutherans to know a little bit about the synod and what role it has played. It's interesting if you look at the history of synods as to the services they have rendered. Obviously, synods didn't come into existence just because people wanted to have one other layer of church government. The first reason for synods, back in the colonial period particularly, was as a guarantor of the quality of clergy. I'm going to say a little more about that in the last presentation, but suffice it at this point to say that the ministerium, the gathering of the ministers at every synod meeting, was important because they were the ones who judged doctrine and who examined candidates for the ministry. They would, in the early years, in fact, put tasks to the candidates, assign them to individual clergy as apprentices, so to speak, read their journals, and examine them orally and in written form to find out if they were ready for licensure and finally for ordination. That tradition of evaluating clergy has continued to be a part of the synodical level of activity within the LCA. Soon, however, synods were given a new task by their congregations, and that was the task to become a channel for common activity. When congregations got strong enough to want to have clergy trained at seminaries, when they wanted to form colleges, and ultimately when they became interested in the foreign mission enterprise and wanted to collect money for overseas work, the synod was the natural channel for that. And therefore, the synod began to become a financial channel for congregational giving, particularly for joint projects either at home, such as institutions and home missions, or overseas. That has also continued, although in some respects world mission and home mission activity has been delegated on to the national church body. But colleges and seminaries have continued to be fairly strongly funded through synodical channels. The final stage in synodical development is one that has occurred very subtly, and I think most of us are unaware of it, and that is that the synod has become more and more looked to as the origin and source for services to congregations. It's only in the last 50 years that synods have become able to support full-time staff. Earlier, synod presidents were pastors who served the synod in the afternoon, writing a few letters, and often did not have a great deal of responsibility other than corresponding with clergy and caring for particular issues that would arise in congregations. But since the advent of full-time staff, the process has been, of course, to add to those staffs, and particularly in youth work and parish education, synods soon became a resource to congregations, and congregations looked to the synod for help. That has widened, and although stewardship and evangelism are projects of national church activity, nevertheless congregations seem to expect support from Synod headquarters in these regards, and through committees as well as and commissions, as well as through staff, synods have tended to answer that call. And thus, there's been a whole new role. If you look at a synod budget today, you'll discover that a lot of the work that the synod is involved in financially is work that's been developed by congregational demand and comes in to help with local projects or with strengthening ministry in the congregation. Now that is somewhat brief, and for those of you who are members of the LCA may sound very dull, but I'm surprised at the fact that even those of us within the tradition have not realized how synods have changed in their role. They've not transformed themselves, they've added, they've taken on additional functions through time, and have now assimilated most of those I've mentioned. The LCA is the largest of the Lutheran bodies, with a baptized membership of 2.9 million. We're all aware, I think, that the church bodies here on the West Coast are of fairly equal size, depending on the area of the coast. It's the same way in Florida, where they are approximately equal in size. In other parts of the country, however, they're points of origin, their early immigration history has pretty well determined that in the East, of course, LCA is very strong. In the Midwest, ALC and LCMS, AELC also across the upper Midwest is strong, coming out of the old English district. And the Sun Belt and growth areas all tend to see the church bodies growing with approximately equal fervor and interest. LCA Lutherans believe in the tithe, but they don't want to insist on it. They also believe that Lutherans with spotlights on their pulpits are probably not very good preachers. Sorry. LCA Lutherans who have not been on church councils don't know what church councils do, they say. LCA Lutherans who have been on church councils say they're not sure either what church councils do. Well, my final comments are simply to relate to you a bit about what is going on right now, or at least was going on last week, in terms of the first stages in this process of forming a new Lutheran church. A week ago today, the representatives, the 70 representatives of the three Lutheran church bodies gathered at St. Benedict's Center in Madison, Wisconsin. Of the 70 members who had been elected 3 weeks before, 2 weeks before really, 69 were present for the meeting. And I think that gives you some indication of the commitment and the excitement that was part of that meeting. It was clear from the beginning that the group was divided, but not along church body lines. It was divided among the old bureaucrats like me, and I felt humbled to find myself suddenly among those suspected by others as being insiders who were going to do something to these folks who had been elected, and the newer people, the people who were serving on such a church-wide body for the first time. It came up with the first votes. We were trying to decide we needed to adopt an agenda. You normally do that at the beginning of a meeting. We didn't. What did the agenda mean, they wanted to know. What were we locking ourselves into? They wanted to talk about it. So we divided into groups. Now, how do you divide into groups? Who decides who's going to be in what group? So we discussed the method of dividing into groups for some time. And finally it was decided that we would do it by counting off. Relieved at this inventive solution to the problem and discovering that our names were all listed in alphabetical order with numbers beside them, it was decided we didn't even have to count off. We could just look at the number of our name and divide by four and then take the remainder. And you were either a zero, a one, a two, or a three. Well, the zeros were upset at that. So we declared them ones and made the ones twos and the twos threes and the threes fours. That was another 15 minutes there. Now we divide into groups. There were 14 people in my group. 10 of them were old line bureaucrats like me. We looked at each other. We had been instructed the first thing we were doing was to give our name, where we were from, what our church body was, and why we were there. 10 of us passed. And now, the dynamics were difficult at first until we discovered why it was that these people were so nervous and skittish. They were worried that these old line bureaucrats were simply going to put three churches together, trading this for that, A for B, and not really try to seize this opportunity to do something new. Well, that sounded pretty good to us, that we really have, I think, a group of 70 people who are committed not to doing the same old thing the same old way. And we then got down to work, and we had some real arguments, but we were able to achieve the first steps necessary to move. We did adopt an agenda, and over some discussion, even Robert's Rules of Order were finally approved for parliamentary procedure, and we were able then to select two task groups. We also debated 15 minutes whether they should be called study committees or task groups. But I think it was task groups or task forces. I'm not sure. Anyway, it wasn't what was recommended. Study committees were recommended, and they thought that was probably, there was probably some devious reason for that, and they therefore decided that a different name would be appropriate. So it's either task forces or task groups. But one of them on theological issues, and that one will be dealing with the very key questions toward a statement of faith, ministry and mission, and church membership and definition of the church. And it's going to deal with it first theologically. The people put on it are not all, again, old-line theologians. The members of the commission did not want a large number of commission members on these subcommittees. They wanted to spread it out and try to get more people involved. The one on the theological foundations will be a group of about 15 people. And then one on sociological trends, data, the world. They wanted a committee to start working on the context in which this new church was going to exist, try to begin to study and see how the church might best respond to that. So on the one hand, we're doing theological work. On the other, a larger group, 20, because of the specialties involved, is going to be studying the society and try to see what shape and what sort of church, in terms of its structure, would be best suited for that kind of ministry and mission. So we've got nobody working on church structure at this time. We've got nobody trying to decide how many of what there's going to be and where they're going to be put. We've not got any committee on church name or church headquarters. And it seems to me that the concept that it must be viewed afresh. We must start with a new vision. God does not give us this kind of opportunity in every generation, and it seems to me that the people that were elected are going to be committed, and they're not going to let anybody do the same old thing just because it's easy or convenient or assume that's the way to do it. I'm looking forward to the next meeting of the commission, which will be in February, and we will get our first report from the theological subcommittee at that time. And for those of you in the three church bodies involved, you may expect that at your spring meetings or your district or synodical meetings, province meetings, whatever they will be, there will be some study document which will begin to raise the theological concerns about the church, about the mission of the church, so that you can participate with a commission on the task of beginning to decide what is the best way to organize ourselves as a new Lutheran church. Still 1982. There may be some surprises yet this year, but this has been an extremely important year for Lutherans in this country, and I hope that the picture that we've taken of ourselves this year will go in the family album, because in a few years we'll look back and say, wasn't it quaint the way we looked in 1982? Now we have about four minutes. If there are some people here that would like to correct me on one or another of my... If I sometimes sound sarcastic or if I kid too hard about things, please don't take me that seriously. I sometimes get carried away, and I don't mean to be slighting or patronizing of any of the groups. Anything? Well, congratulate yourselves for staying awake in the semi-darkness. I guess you're awake. Any comments or corrections? Yeah. I'm sorry, I meant to say the Lutheran Church in America had a Finney Special Interest Conference. I didn't mean to say ULCA. Yeah. 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 And then the Slovak Zion Synod became a sort of non-geographical synod with us. Continued that tradition. No. Now there's only one listed. Yes, I had recalled two of them, but now it's just one listed in the official listing with a membership of some 100 congregations, I think. Maybe that's too many. I think I have that note here. Yeah, excuse me. 36. Yes. Yes, one of the questions was whether we should invite representatives of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod to be observers. I think there's strong sentiment for that in the group. It was one of the questions that kind of became a casualty to the discussion of process, but I'm sure that it will be raised again. I believe that the planning committee, there is a smaller group of 15 or so people that are operating as a kind of agenda-setting group for the larger committee. And I believe that was given the task of proposing something on this. We did agree that there would be observers from the Canadian church bodies, because they are, of course, also in the process of merger, and ask that they invite a representative from our group to work with them. So I'm very hopeful that there will be Missouri Synod observers present. I think many are. Appreciate your mentioning that. Okay, well, thanks for the start, and lights have been off.